Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm Clara Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones and your moderator for tonight's program. Our speaker tonight is Arlie Hochschild, professor emerita, that is a hard word to say, of sociology at UC Berkeley and the author of the National Book Award finalist, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Arlie has thought of herself as a progressive for most of her life, but she felt that America's political divide was growing and she wanted to better understand those on the right. Her book is a result of painstaking field work, years of it, and since its publication, she's traveled all over the country discussing how we can move forward in such a contentious political landscape. Arlie, thank you for joining us. You know, there's been a lot of consternation that the media has spent entirely too much time since the election obsessing over Trump voters, but you began this project long before he ran for president, so can you tell us what prompted you?
Yes, you know, it was in 2011, and I remember sitting in my office in the sociology department at Berkeley, and it wasn't a secret then. I think many of us felt a tension. Congress was at a gridlock. Nothing could get passed. Rhetoric even then was already escalating, and I thought, look, is anything that I've called for and wanted to see happen going to happen when there's a rising movement of people that think that the government, rather than being an instrument, a good guy government that could be an instrument that could bring out all these good changes, was the problem, was the thing you had to cut down at the root. I thought, it just bothered me. And I said, I don't know anybody that's a member of the Tea Party enthusiast. And in fact, my husband didn't know anybody, and my children didn't know, and our neighbors didn't know anybody. So I was in a bubble, and both a geographic bubble, the coasts and the cities, and a media bubble. I was reading the New York Times and the Washington Post and Mother Jones and not listening to Fox News. And like at that time, an electronic bubble, because given the algorithms, as we all open our laptops, they give us ourselves back to us. So I thought I'm going to have to get out of my bubble and see if I can find another bubble that's as far right as the state of California, the city of Berkeley, the Department of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. See if I could find that place. And where would that be? Well, that would be in the South. That's where the right had grown the fastest and strongest. And where in the South? Well, how about the Super South? Where the proportion of whites who had voted for Barack Obama in 2012 was in Louisiana, only 14%, whereas in the whole region of the South, it was 30%. So I thought, okay, perfect. And then within Louisiana, where would I go? Well, there was this, they described themselves as the buckle in America's energy belt. So proud petrochemical and oil center around southwest Louisiana, Lake Charles. And I had one stroke of good luck. I knew one person in the state, and that was the mother-in-law of a former student of mine, who was progressive. She was a wonderful artist and really my home away from home during the 5 years of doing research. But her best friend was an ardent member of the Tea Party. And they had been sorority sisters at Louisiana State University, and they went, they had keys to each other's houses. Their kids knew and loved each other. They knew each other's parents. It was like a three-generational relationship. And they both loved culture and went to plays together. But they were both ardent, and they were absolutely opposites. So I got fascinated with that. So, and the idea with it was to really try and take my moral and political alarm system off for a while and permit myself a lot of interest and curiosity about people in whose shoes I did not stand and in whose shoes I wanted to try and stand, and to climb an empathy wall with people that I knew I had profound differences with, that knew that going in, of course. So, you know, people would ask me, gosh, well, that you must have a lot of empathy. And my answer to that is no, no more than anyone else. Actually, I think we all have enormous reservoirs of empathy and stand in the shoes of others. Maybe especially progressives are good at that. And it's just that we don't apply that quality to investigating the other.
So what were the initial things you were hoping to discover? Or what did the object of your investigation change as time went on and you spent more time with people?
Yes, it did, actually. As I settled in there, for one thing, I began to realize that when I got in my car and crossed the I-10 bridge from Lake Charles to Westlake, my eyes would begin to sting. Mm. And it was a haze over land. And then I looked that up. It was the one within the 1.5% most polluted counties, Calcasieu County, in the entire country. Mm. And the whole state has the second highest death rate from cancer for men. So I thought, well, wait a minute. Here are the people I'm interviewing, which are people who are enthusiastic about the Tea Party. They opposed regulating polluters. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in this question of self-interest, you could say, and came at it with this red state paradox, which many of us, I think, have wondered about. How could it be that across the country, it's the poorest states, the states with the most disrupted families, the most accidents, the worst education, the worst health care, the worst health, the highest proportion of the most pollution are also the states that receive more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars and hate the federal government. So, and then I discovered Louisiana was an exaggerated version. I'd come to exactly the right place because it's second poorest state, has all those troubling rates, 44% of the state budget comes from the federal government, and overwhelmingly Tea Party. I thought I'd come to find this or that, you know, person who was enthusiastic about the Tea Party, but no, it was a general premise. And they all later voted for Trump.
And it's interesting because you write about how they had a real sense of shame about government help broadly defined,
right,
but right, didn't really think about this being in a state where there was more money coming in than going out, for example.
Yes, it's interesting. I would ask them in the course of things, well, what are you grateful to the federal government for?
Not even the GI Bill didn't come up?
Well, it was really interesting. There'd be a long pause and a shuffling around. Well, asked a bad question. And then they would honestly were kind of mulling it over. Well, the I-10, and that would be the Interstate 10 that takes you from Texas to Mississippi through Louisiana. So that was federal. And then the GI Bill, yeah, military, that was good. And then you would get stoppages. Well, guess that's it. And I'd say, well, how about the safety of your food? Oh, yes, yes. You know. And then I would say, is there anyone in your family who has been on unemployment? Yes, yes, the person themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, unemployment. Well, how about food stamps? Well, yes, my brother, da-da-da-da. And one guy said, oh, yes, of course, we all use these things, and disability and Medicaid, because we figure, well, if we pay for it, might as well use it. Mm-hmm. But there was shame about it, and they wanted to distinguish themselves from those who were government users.
So for the past 2 years, the country's been really hotly debating whether the Trump base, you know, sort of the Tea Partiers that morphed into the Trump base, has been primarily motivated by economic insecurity or by racial resentment. But it seems your observations would indicate that these things are very deeply intertwined, and I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit.
Yes, I think race is front and central. But it's not alone. It's complex. It's a web. I feel like the people I got to know over those 5 years were the elite of the left behind. You know, they weren't abjectly poor, no. They came from very difficult circumstances. It was kind of a refrain, oh, we were poor, but we didn't know it. But they'd risen up, they were proud of it, but they felt that the country was like a tent kind of collapsing on them and that their sources of pride were squeezed and eroded. If they, for example, what could they feel proud of? Well, could they feel proud of being from the South? Well, no, there was always the moral North wagging its moral finger. And they were seen, they felt that, quote, we saw them as backward and were very alert to that, very diffident. Well, I know a lot of you people think we're backward, but we're not. Or religion, they saw that the trends were toward people who were secular, and so that felt like they were declining. They saw themselves as blue collar, you know, but they felt that that class kind of was being squeezed with the loss of the industrial sector. And they felt, as whites and as men, that somehow they weren't permitted pride and they were being demographically squeezed, too. So in a variety of ways, and they, certainly with regard to social values, they felt like the country had run ahead of them and left them behind, and was blaming them as racist and sexist and homophobic, and then saying, "And you're a redneck." Mm-hmm. So they just felt left behind in this way. So it isn't just race, or it isn't just gender, it isn't just economics. It seemed like it was a kind of an honor squeeze they were in. And then when the Pied Piper came for a primary rally in New Orleans and came down in his airplane.
Air Force One.
Air Force One. Well, Trump, it was before he won, so the Trump plane, Trump, and came down, you know, from the sky, from heaven, you know, and he said to them, you know, you've lost, we're going backwards. Hillary Clinton says you're moving forward, there's no problem, but I know I'm your guy because I understand that you feel you're losing. The whole country's going back, needs to be made great again. It rang their social class race bell.
And it's interesting that something that Trump really tapped into unconsciously or consciously was this notion that folks seem to have that people were cutting in line.
Right.
That they were being held back, but it wasn't because of anything they were doing. It's because people unfairly were being jumped ahead of them.
That's right. And I put that in a certain way in the book, that you could list what people's attitudes were, mm-hmm. but I didn't get at what I felt were the feelings that for both left and right, mm-hmm. I think there is something that we could call a deep story. And what is a deep story? A deep story is a story where you take the facts out and you take moral precepts out. And what you've got is what feels true about a salient situation. And you can tell it like a dream as a metaphor, and I do in the book. And in this right-wing deep story, people are waiting in line as in a pilgrimage, and it faces the top of the hill where you see the American dream. And people felt their feet were facing forward, and that the line hadn't moved in a very long time. People hadn't had a raise in 2 decades, people hadn't interviewed. And that they felt that they were deserving of that American dream, that they had worked hard, they'd obeyed by the rules, and that they didn't begrudge anyone. This is important. The idea is, don't begrudge anybody, but that at a moment, second moment in the deep story, there are, as you say, line cutters. Well, who would they be? They would be, through federally mandated affirmative action programs, blacks finally being given access to jobs that had always been reserved for whites, and even worse, women, who were finally being given access to jobs that had always been reserved for men. And on top of that were undocumented migrants and even refugees, mm-hmm. and even the oil-soaked, a kind of brown pelican, which is Louisiana's state bird, which became extinct, actually, had to get some Florida brown pelicans to resuscitate them. So it comes waddling up, and it cuts in line. Many people said, oh, those environmentalists put animals ahead of people. So another moment of the right-wing deep story, there's Barack Obama waving to the line cutters. Oh, he's their president. Mm-hmm. Now, he's not representing me. In fact, he's causing me to be squeezed back. And then people would say, well, isn't he a line cutter? Mm-hmm. I mean, I heard again and again, how did his mother, who was lower middle class mother, she was not rich, how did she afford a Harvard education, a Columbia education? Something fishy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, went there.
Which is really interesting that, you know, we are all very familiar with the birther phenomenon, but when we were working on a piece off of this book, that story that you kept telling about how they felt Obama was somehow must be a fraud.
Right.
That it just couldn't be.
Right.
Was just really fascinating that, you know, and and very, very deep, deeply held bias, I guess.
Yes,
that's where to put it, you know. But
it is bias.
But it was fascinating that no amount of evidence, both in his demeanor in office nor, you know, records from the state of Hawaii and elsewhere,
I know,
could shake people of that feeling that it must be fraudulent.
Right, right, right. And, of course, Trump played to that.
Yes, more than I think we really realized at the time. You said that there was also a lot of resentment towards, you know, politically correct culture. Did that equate essentially to the line cutters, or was there something, another overlay on that?
They felt that progressives, people on the coasts, and that they felt were alien and other, were telling them that they felt the wrong feelings and that they weren't good people, mm-hmm. that they were bad people. They felt judged and insulted by it. Who are these people that don't even know? And, you know, some of these interviews, the way I would do it would be, as I came to know, and I talked to some 50 people over the 5 years, I would let them present themselves to me the way they wanted to be seen. In other words, I didn't say, well, now tell me exactly where you were born and where to go to school. And I would say, well, tell me something about yourself. And after a while, the first thing they wanted me to know about them is that they worked hard. That they worked hard, and that sometimes it was dangerous work, mm-hmm. in these plants, for example. And there might be a half an hour description of a particular procedure you do in the plant and how you had to run, or you could, you know, and your thumb could get caught in the machine. And I didn't understand each of these, you know, complicated procedures they were describing, but it certainly was clear that they wanted me to define them, first of all, as workers and hard workers. They didn't think about work the way I think about work. I think I work hard, too. But I would, I guess, when I think of work, is am I doing it as well as I can? You know? They never said, look, I'm a good worker. Or is my work going to make a difference? Is it going to make a better world? You know, it's going to have an effect. They don't say that either. It's just that I work and I work hard. So that was a thing to learn, you know, just how they wanted to be seen and the primacy of that.
And do you think that was mostly because they just didn't have the opportunities to have jobs that could be kind of motivating and interesting in that way? That, you know, the working hard had to be the reward because they weren't allowed the agency to...
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's right. And I didn't just go to a different region. I went to a different class and learned a lot about class. And I came home thinking, well, we speak of Wall Street and Main Street, but that doesn't leave room for the people I came to know. Mm-hmm. They're not Main Street either. They don't own shops. But they put in the wiring, you know. They put in the plumbing in the shop. And we don't even have a way of honoring that or naming it as giving it primacy.
I mean, that makes me wonder. You hear liberals say a lot that, you know, why do they vote against their interests? Is a sort of common trope about working class conservatives. And I'm wondering what you now think that framing fails to take into account, and also if anyone ever talked to you about how that statement in particular was enraging. I imagine it would be.
Yes, I mean, my very question. Yes, I think if go back to the deep story and what felt true to them, it does seem in their interest to, oppose a line cutter president in politics, and their view of progressives is that all they're doing is rooting for more line cutters and rendering them invisible. And it made me realize the importance of recognition. You know, even if you're not agreeing on the issues, or you can't say, look, let's just be results-oriented, can't we agree on reducing prison populations, for example, which I think there is a lot of, or getting clean energy. Again, a lot of just possible agreement across these lines. But they didn't feel recognized, and they felt irked, and they felt that there was a bunch of nerds that got into elite schools and got told that they were the top of the cream of the crop and that everybody else was dumber. It was irksome.
Did you see any generational differences in the deep story? Did young people kind of hold this narrative as strongly as people who were older in these communities?
In this project, I was just talking to older people because I was going for the right thing story. But I've been doing some interviews since, and I think younger people are really, again, looking at white, blue-collar, but Midwestern. And the young are, they're Bernie people. They're dissociated, once I've talked with their some I haven't even registered, but faced with bad economic prospects, they talk about, well, maybe there should be, a living wage for everybody. I said, oh, do you know Finland's talking about that? but they're younger. So I think if we want to make common cause, I think it's good to look at young people.
I think it was another interesting thing that you explored was how people in talking to you would say that even though they were self-identified Tea Partiers and later Trump supporters, they actually spoke up for more government benefits as long as they thought it went to people like them.
Right. I think what got under their skin is that people weren't working like they were and didn't deserve to loaf. I mean, there would be these pictures. So, they clearly were for Medicare. They didn't mind that at all. So the government, here's the interesting thing. When I first got there, all they talked about was the national debt. One woman even had a clock in a public school for her fourth grade. It was the accumulating national debt. Finally, someone found out about it. Yeah. Like this time bomb. And when I went back, I've been back three times since the book, talked to my people. And there's not a word said about the debt. No.
Which then really begs an interesting question about what was the Tea Party movement really about?
It does.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
More about the debt or more about their perception that this was things given to people who were not like them.
That's right, and who were one down, who were behind them in line, and should stay behind unless they were workers exactly like them. So, yeah, it's interesting, and in the book I argue that there are really two class tension points. For the left, what we're looking at Main Street and the 1%, you know, the 99%, the 1%, that the point of tension, of social class tension, is there. Mm-hmm. It's between most people and the 1% that's getting astronomically richer by the year. But for the people I came to know, that disappeared. That was hazy. What was really hot, this tension point, was between the lower middle class and those below who seemed to be in alliance with the king. You know, it's like a king-peasantry alliance against, you know, the middle. So that was the social class point in tension, yeah.
I have a number of questions here that are asking essentially, how did you go about building trust in your field work? And then I think we can come back later to how do we all go about this in a broader way. But how did you do that?
How did I do that? Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure I could to begin with, actually, to tell the truth. It was felt experimental. And I started with the one person, the mother-in-law that... who was liberal, but she, and who had her extreme right-wing friend, and we started with focus groups. So there was a group of six of the friends of the one, a group of six of the friends of the other, and then we did it again, another six. I interviewed everybody, and then did what we call snowballing in such exploratory research, where I would interview a wife, and then her husband would be there. I'd be invited for lunch, say, could I talk to you? And then the grandparents and neighbors, so you sort of snowball out. That was one way I did it. I hope I'm getting at this question right. And then, so the trust was built partly because I knew somebody they knew. I joined, started to go to meetings of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana. That was interesting. There'd be a rifle being raffled off, the pledge and the prayer. And then I followed a Republican candidate that was running for office and his Tea Party rival, and then... I followed around an environmentalist who said, oh, I have a lot of friends who hate what I'm doing. And so I said, could I follow you around and meet these friends that hate what you're doing? So those were all ways that I got around. But trust, I think it went like this. First of all, I would say, hi, I'm Arlie Hochschild, the unpronounceable last name. And... I teach. I'm retired. I think it helped. Yeah. And I'm worried about this divide in our country. And then I would get a nod. Yeah, we're worried about this. Gotten awfully bitter. And in church, we don't, you know, talk like that or believe in talking like that. And it's not right. Doesn't sit well. And then I would say, so I'm looking to see if we don't have more in common with each other than we think we do, or at least we can be respectful. So I'm just exploring this. This is, and would you help me? Would you let me interview you? And for certain people, I asked, and can I see where you were born? And often, these were stayers, where they lived and where they were born is very close by. And where'd you go to school and what row did you sit in? You know, where'd you go to church? And how often? Where are your parents buried? In the course of all this, and especially if you go fishing, or you make a gumbo together, you know, that it relaxes people. Mm. And in the course of things, people were kind. They came to me. They gave me this gift, and I took it as a gift. And they kind of said, look, I know the people you hang out with, they look down on us, but will you really tell them how we really are? And I thought to myself, that's actually exactly what I want to do, you know? So I would say exactly why I'm not like you, you know? And we do have our differences, but is that the end of the story? Well, I mean, there was one woman that it was so interesting how I felt trust with her. She was at this Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana. We were a table of eight, and she said, oh, I love Rush Limbaugh. I thought, holy Christ. And then I thought, oh, yes, the empathy wall. Oh, I'd love to talk to you about that. Can we meet for sweet teas? And so the next day we did. And then I said, so what is it that you love about Rush Limbaugh? Oh, he's my brave heart. He hates the feminazis. And I thought, I hope she hasn't Googled me.
Card carrying.
Second shift. So I'm saying, well, what is a feminazi? Oh, it's a cold, hard, mean, ambitious, me first person. And I thought, that sounds like Ayn Rand. You know, you're these right wing icons. But to her, it's that. I said, well, okay. And then she went on to environmental wackos and so on. Well, what is an environmental wacko? Well, so it went like that. And then she stopped and she said, is it hard for you to hear me? Because I know you don't agree with what I'm saying. And I said, no, actually, it's not hard at all because I have my alarm system off and I'm here to find out about you, and you are being very generous and giving me something very precious to me, which is your experience and your upbringing, and it's helping me understand you. And she said then, I know what you're doing. I do that too. I do it with my kids. I do it with my parishioners. She turned out to be a gospel singer in an enormous megachurch, a Pentecostal megachurch. She took me to the Pentecostal megachurch, and her husband, who turned out to be the minister, and announced people, oh, we have with us today.
Berkeley Femina.
Arlie Horshosh, who wants to understand us Southerners, us Southern people. So afterwards, it was so sweet. People came up. Oh, you folks anywhere near Stockton? You know, or we bring the camper truck to Vallejo. You pretty close there. So, and they travel like we do, kind of within, you know, red corridors. We have these blue corridors. But it was very sweet and wonderful. And I felt like when we had that little empathy leap thing in charge, then she said, I'm forgetting the main point, which was she then said, you know why I really like Rush Limbaugh? I feel like he protects me against people who think that I'm backward and ill-educated and a fat slob. And so that protection sounded interesting, mm-hmm. and it never had occurred to me. So learned a lot there.
So you first published the book more than a year ago. You've been in touch with many of these subjects since then. What are they feeling now about Trump, about the political divide?
Yeah. The last time I went back, I took my son, who is he's a member of the California Energy Commission in charge of renewables. And I took him, and we stayed with a man who opens the book, who has worked in oil all his life. Big Tea Party, big Trump person. And I wanted to say, look, I'm just going to hold the tape recorder. Can you guys see if you can find some common ground on cleaning up the environment? And so that was quite amazing thing. But he, in that atmosphere of going fishing and doing gumbos, the three of us, my son asked Mike Schaff, well, do you have any reservations about Donald Trump? And Mike, who's a, if you look at his Facebook page, it's Trump, 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 you know. But in that context, Mike's answer was, where do I begin? Yeah. Yeah. If you talk to people in an open way and you with a listening orientation, this turns out to be a powerful, powerful thing. And it's not that he doesn't have strong feelings. The strongest one is on a right to life. That's his big thing. But he also felt that the country needed a shakeup. It was going the wrong way. And the Democrats, that's the main thing. That was the come-away point, is that they saw nothing for them in the Democratic Party, the party of the working man, the working woman. They just didn't see anything for them. They felt edged out by it, in fact, and taken over by neoliberal policies, disregarded their anxieties. So, but when you, and he can say this, so the bloom is off the rose, I would say. They don't, you know, they have a lot of criticisms, but, and they've kind of had to eat crow, what, you know, one thing after another they don't like about him. But that just shows you how desperate they are, that they don't see something else. And that's the challenge of this book to us.
And what do you think you talk about the politics of respect. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's that the left is failing to do, or is it specific policies or a combination of the two? Like, what is not reaching people?
Oh, many things. I mean, this is not easy, and I actually think that the first thing we have to do is to defend the Constitution and democracy. And I think that Trump is kicking at its heels. I don't think you need to talk to someone who's different from you on that. I think that comes first. I think revamping the Democratic Party platform and its rhetoric is number two. And I think getting the vote out is number three. But I think number four, in coordination, and these are in order of importance, but in coordination, needs to be to reach out. And we should remember that among Trump voters, were some 6 by estimates, 6.5 by other estimates, 8 million people who voted for Barack Obama last time, right? Wouldn't you want to have a conversation? And that some 1 out of 4 people who voted for Trump, of white, blue-collar people that voted for Trump, would have voted for Bernie Sanders if he had been the Democratic candidate. They were for him in the primary. So wouldn't you want to have a conversation there? And I think respect is a way of opening the door to serious conversations. It's what you have to do first. And, you know, maybe it would be worth reading one of the letters. My email and mailbox has been wild. Wild. Oh, my goodness. But this is a recent one. And I just finished Strangers in Their Own Land. Thank you for such a thoughtful treatment of a subject near and dear to me. What a refreshing take on such a fractious subject, and with good humor and a respect seldom afforded to the people I love and serve from the opposite side of the empathy wall. I have, in my own small way for the last 20 years, tried to look beyond that wall and build a bridge between these two radically different American cultures. I am a poster boy for all of the cliches of the Old South. I am a descendant of John C. Calhoun. The men that worked in my grandfather's fields were descended from slaves my family once owned. This is a moral burden that I have never yet resolved personally, nor it seems has our nation done so collectively. My paternal grandfather, along with his 5 sons, all worked for Chevron during the early Louisiana oil boom. As a result, my family moved to the Delta, to South Louisiana, so I grew up with the Cajun people you depict in your book. I'm a Southern Baptist pastor, in East Texas. My last 3 congregational representatives have been Tom DeLay, Ron Paul, and now Louis Gohmert. I gladly voted for each of these men. Those 3 men probably aptly define the bubble I live and work in, and also give you a few clues about me. The kind of people that vote for those men are the kind of people who ask me to be their spiritual leader. I now live and work in Kilgore, Texas. Having given up a comfortable position as senior pastor at the NASA Church in Houston, 75% of our parishioners worked at NASA. As I said, for the past 20 years, I've actively participated in formal and informal debates, symposia, conversations intended to bridge the gap between the two different American cultures. These have involved friends. They're a strange mix from mild to militant activists for atheists, secularism, Christianity, Islam, conservative and liberal politics, gay rights. It's been a very diverse group of people, limited only by our ability to talk in our best moments civilly about our considerable differences. He goes on to say, to be honest, I've been completely disheartened by the election of President Trump. How is a Baptist minister to explain his unwillingness to support an egotistical, lying bigot that brags about his extramarital affairs, makes a living from casinos complete with strip clubs? How has our divide come to this? But then he ends this... he's telling me I should do another book, and it says, I don't know who that person, he said I should try and find someone on the other side and write about it, but I will be first in line to buy that big book if you should take on such a project. Thank you again for the work you are doing. I have been encouraged in a most discouraging year from the most unlikely of places, Berkeley, California.
I'm curious.
And you know what I've done? So I wrote him back, thanked him fulsomely, and said, actually, I've been talking with some young people who want to go on a listening tour. Mm. These are from People's Action. Oh, they're very... but I did talk to them, and they did. I did a Skype with them, so I put them in touch.
I'm curious, since he mentioned the dubious attitude towards women that has been evidenced by our president, what kind of opening do you think the Me Too movement has in these circles, if any? And I guess I would ask the same about the, you know, emerging activism around gun control after the Parkland massacre.
Right. I think a lot of crossover is possible with Me Too, especially in such churches. Mm-hmm. You know, our feelings are very strong on these issues of ethical behavior, and I think they feel defiled by Trump. They would, so it would have to be done gently and openly, but yes, that's a great thing. And there's a church, there's, I think, struggle going on in these churches. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I would start with the young. Yeah, that's a perfect one. And you know, it's interesting. I think the whole idea of being a patriot, we could really work with that. The people I came to know felt deeply American. And you could see flags everywhere on mailboxes, on, you know, clothing, trucks. And I think the Democratic Party could say, we're the party of United States, and we're devoted to it, and that the principle that makes America distinctive is democracy, a free press, independent judiciary. In other words, the people that I came to know would say they're patriotic and they would die for their country. But it wouldn't be hard to kind of say yes, and that's honorable, but then what are the principles you would die for? Aren't we... In other words, I think there are lots of missed opportunities to come together, and that's a very important, I think,
do you think it's common ground. Possible to kind of knit those narratives together when we are also in our own news and information bubbles? I mean, I'm sure you came up against the teachings of Fox News and others in this research, and when people can't agree on just basic facts.
Right, right. But what if, you talked about the Me Too movement, and we know that fewer women voted. It was a big gender gap in even right-wing votes for Trump, but certainly the whole population. I think, what was it, 37-53, so it's a quite large gender gap. But what if feminists were to say, but we see that men are in a crisis now too, and that our boys aren't doing well in school, that they're, I think 70% of valedictorians now in high school are girls, and what's going on, you know? And if you look at what blue-collar white men are doing, and there's been a lot of research on this, it's like this, what had happened to black men in the 60s is happening to white blue-collar men now. And marriage rates are really down, and fathers are more estranged from their kids. What if people were to say, look, we need some groups that encourage dads to be good dads? Church says, you know, how about that? How about that? Wouldn't that be a great crossover issue? And it's something that feminists have been calling for a long, long time. Try the second shift. And the hero of that book was the dad who got it, how important that was. So there are opportunities, but we need to have a big think about them and put that in the room.
And have you seen things that are starting to work at scale? I mean, it's one thing for someone as solicitous and diplomatic and as well-trained as you to go spend 5 years and build a real rapport, but how are people, what are some experiments that you've seen that you find hope in being able to do this at a larger scale or with people less trained in sociology than you?
Okay, there is under the radar, we don't know about it, but a whole movement across the country. And if you would Google the Bridge Alliance, there are actually two things that will come up, but there's one, the real one's about bridges, I think, but the other is an organization. It's an umbrella group over what are now 80 different small little startups with names like Hi from the Other Side or Making Family Dinner Again. So some have a humor to them, but one is Living Room Conversations, which is the brainchild of Joan Blades, the co-founder of MoveOn.org here in the Bay Area. It's the largest progressive website, and she's a mediation lawyer, and I've done one of these with one of the people that I write about in the preface to the book, came and was our guest at home, my husband and myself, she and her two children. We had one of these living room conversations with right and left together, eight people, and you pick a particular issue. The fact that there are this many groups, I find heartening. I find it heartening that actually George Soros and the Koch brothers could both put money into reducing prison populations for nonviolent offenders. You know, this can be done. And I find hope in the Reverend Williams, who he's the Moral Mondays guy, who has said next Mother's Day, he's organized 30 cities to demonstrate for poor children across the country. And that's a kind of coalitional issue, a kind of, it's not an enclave issue. And so I take, he's getting buy-in for that. I take hope from the fact that many of the people I talk to kind of liked Bernie Sanders. Mm. Yeah. Oh, Uncle Bernie. I didn't say Aunt Hillary. But they said, oh, he's a socialist. We're a capitalist country. No, he's wrong about that. But there's a kind of a liking to this guy. So that gives me hope.
And do you put that on that they agreed with Bernie's economic and other policies, or do you put it on sexism towards Hillary, or what kind of combination would you throw in there?
I put it on that Bernie was questioning the structure that something was fundamentally flawed and hurting our democracy. They nodded their heads at that.
So do you think that these folks would vote for a woman, if not Hillary?
Yes, I do. I do.
Do you think that a sociologist who was black or brown would have been able to do this research and undertake this book?
No. Oh, no, I don't think so. No. You know, not for this group. I don't think so. They would have felt probably accused, you know, oh my goodness, someone's going to find fault with us. And So in this particular instance, skin privilege that I'm using.
I mean, it's interesting because another person who's been doing this sort of conversation has been Van Jones, who's been
with
his love army. And so they're someone who's at least trying to kind of conduct the same things, but with racial differences thrown in. And
Yes. And even our friend, Reverend Kilgore, wrote me proudly. He's now writing me, telling me about all the crossover stuff he's done. And he said there is a black parishioner who is progressive, but who's he's working with, and who described how he'd gotten a new car, but he was pulled over so many times in Texas that he gave the car up. So that's now part of the story that this guy Kilgore tells. We need to exchange stories. You know what I really think we need? Okay. In the immediate term, I think these four pillars of activism coordinate with one another, so we act as a unified, loyal opposition. But I also think we need something more fundamental, because now votes left and right are really votes about region and social class. And we used to have ways of mixing up regions and social class. We used to have the compulsory draft before the early 70s. We used to have that mixed soldiers up, or we used to have a vibrant union movement and that mixed workers of different sorts up. We used to have public schools that everybody went to. Those are no longer effective mixers. So what do we do? I think we need a new mechanism overall, and I would like to do it through high schools.
Like a national exchange?
A national exchange, internal.
Freaky Friday, exchange. Everybody
That's
around
right.
the country.
That's right. So don't go to Rome on your, or Paris. I'd like to see kids from the coast go inland, and inland kids for a month be hosted by families on the coast. I'd like the South to go north. I'd like the North to go south. And I'd like the kids to prep for it with a course on how to talk civilly and respectfully, kind of media skills of a mediator. That should be part of the curriculum. And civics and history. And so they prepare for this. They get each other's deep stories. And they don't just, in my dream, okay, it's a dream, but I'd like to have them do something with their hands together, like build a house for homeless people or put up solar roofs. Okay, those are my left coast ideas. Let's look if there were other ones. But that they're doing something together, but in the course of doing that with the training they've had, they can really address the big questions that are dividing us.
So I've tried to incorporate as many questions from the audience, which have all been really great, as I can. One last one that I'd like to ask is what is something on the left that we are particularly blinkered about that we need to remove those blinkers and open our eyes? Like, what is a common misperception that we have about the kinds of folks that you met?
That they're not like us in a capacity to maintain doubt, in the capacity to reflect be smart. I think that's blinkering, and that if you get together with people who will impress you in certain ways. But if it's done in an open spirit, I think there will be some human respect, despite being actually more troubled than you were before about the enormity of the differences. So actually, I came away thinking, oh, we are different, but impressed. And if there was a blinkeredness that in myself, I think, fell away, it's the humanity and decency on the other side.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the crowd here at the Commonwealth Club, to thank Arlie Hochschild, I'm going to finally say that right, for joining us this evening. And I want to remind everyone that copies of Arlie's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, is available for sale outside, and she'll be happy to sign yours in just a few minutes. Appreciate you letting her get to the table to sign as soon as she can. I'm Clara Jeffrey, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Ha ha.